From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some behind-the-scenes stories of classic rock and roll songs from the team that wrote them. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller wrote Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Stand By Me, and dozens more. Also today, Young Soul Rebels. It's a new film set in 1977 about the British dance club scene that took off at the same time as punk rock. The director, Isaac Julian, is black and gay and says these clubs were where he used to feel most at home. And just in time for some last-minute Christmas shopping, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead runs down some of his favorite records of the year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Russian Republic has taken over virtually all of the functions and property of the Central Soviet government. Russian President Boris Yeltsin issued decrees taking over the Kremlin, the center of Soviet government operations in Moscow. The Interfax news agency said the decrees were part of an agreement Yeltsin reached yesterday with Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels today agreed to airlift emergency humanitarian aid, including food and medicine, to the Soviet Union. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The statement issued by the NATO foreign ministers said that the emergency aid would, quote, help demonstrate again that the Cold War is behind us and that a new community of shared values and interests is taking root. But in comments made after the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker made clear the aid was necessary for more practical purposes.
Problems they face are very large. They are asking for our help. They need our help, and we should give it. From Yeltsin to Kravchuk, I was told that only a major humanitarian assistance effort could stave off a social explosion.
The foreign ministers also called on the republics of the disintegrating Soviet Union to follow through on arms control treaties previously agreed to by the Kremlin and maintain reliable control of the Soviet nuclear arsenal. I'm John Idsty reporting.
President Bush promised today that he'll pursue free and fair trade practices and jobs for Americans when he travels to Japan and other Asian countries at the end of this month. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush met with a high-profile delegation of American business leaders who will accompany him on the 10-day trip to Australia, Singapore, Korea, and Japan. Among them were American automaker executives. Later, the president told a group of foreign journalists that the trip is designed to create more American jobs.
The trip is to break down intransigence where we find it and have freer and fairer trade. And that message I will carry very, very forcefully.
Mr. Bush leaves for Australia on December 30th. He will arrive in Japan on January 7th. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
There was a sharp increase in new claims for unemployment benefits during the first week in December. The Labor Department reported that the number of Americans applying for state jobless benefits was up by 79,000, bringing the total weekly number of new claims close to 500,000. The rise was nearly twice what most analysts had been expecting. It came after a decline of 61,000 during the last weekend in November. Most observers attributed the decline to the Thanksgiving holiday, which gave newly unemployed workers one less day to file their claims. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to finish the day at 2,914.36. Declines led advances by a margin of about 3-2 in heavy trading of about 200 million shares. This is NPR News. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International has agreed to plead guilty to racketeering charges and to forfeit all of its assets in the United States. Attorney General William Barr called it the largest criminal forfeiture in U.S. history, amounting to about $550 million. The money will be used to reimburse depositors and shore up two American banks that were secretly controlled by BCCI. Barr said that the deal successfully resolves all U.S. charges against the bank. He stressed that the bank has agreed to cooperate in investigations of people who are involved in BCCI's wrongdoings around the world. Celebrations erupted today in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia, when Germany announced it would formally recognize both Croatia and Slovenia. The rest of the European community will follow suit in January. Jason Fear reports from Zagreb.
Gunfire sounded across the Croatian capital of Zagreb tonight following the announcement. As tracer rounds arched through the sky and anti-aircraft rounds exploded overhead, startled citizens rushed for cover out of fear that the city was under attack. The celebrations continued for more than an hour, despite pleas for a ceasefire by Croatian radio. The German cabinet, meeting in Bonn, decided to extend recognition to the two breakaway republics today. However, the move does not take effect until January 15th, when the other 11 members of the European community are also expected to recognize Croatia and Slovenia. Germany becomes the first major nation to recognize the independence of the two republics. However, the Ukraine and the three Baltic republics of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia have already established ties. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Fear in Zagreb.
There was some improvement in the United States' balance of trade with other nations in October. The Commerce Department reported that the U.S. trade deficit declined by 2.9%, largely because of record sales of American goods overseas. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Going to Kansas City.
About 100 different singers recorded that song, from Wilbert Harrison, who had the original hit, to the Beatles and Sammy Davis Jr. My guests are the ones collecting the songwriting royalties, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. This team has written many rock and roll classics for Elvis Presley, the Clovers, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. Their songs include Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Searchin', and Stand By Me. They not only wrote the songs, they often produced them. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on the record for their work. Rock and roll's greatest producer, Phil Spector, got his start as Lieber and Stoller's assistants. Rhino Records has just released a CD of Lieber and Stoller's classic songs. It opens with the original 1953 recording of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton. This was the first session Lieber and Stoller produced themselves.
You ain't nothing!
Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them. And she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about, anywhere from 275 to 350. And she had this really guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her. And we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain, and we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
How did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and
right.
You came up with Hound Dog.
Right, which sort of, made it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama's, really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo, and Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas. Now, I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it, but it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay.
Did
you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly. That's all.
Yeah. Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that?
Warden threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knock.
Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs when he was supposedly graduating high school. I don't think Elvis graduated high school, but maybe he did. But we had to write these terrible songs.
How'd you feel about having to write terrible songs? Why did you enjoy it?
Because it was funny.
Uh-huh.
It was amusing.
Yeah, it was kind of like anti-rock and roll.
Well, the thing was that the problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of them dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark. We wrote novelty songs because we're both essentially gag writers, and we like to tell funny stories and anecdotes. And this is just a way of telling funny stories set to music.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs that's on the Rhino Records anthology that's just been released of some of your songs. And this is Charlie Brown.
V-V-5-5-4-4-4. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me. That's him on his
knees. I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black. And it wasn't really till later on, when you hear these later songs, like 1959 and 60, the Late Coasters things, mm-hmm. that are really kind of generalized rock and roll for mass market. But the early stuff that we wrote things like, our early songs were not really novelty. They were blues. Hound Dog is a buck dance blues for Big Mama. And Kansas City is a 12-bar blues, certainly not a novelty song. All the early stuff, with Jimmy Witherspoon.
And Hard Times that we wrote for Charles Brown.
These are all blues. And we wrote essentially, not essentially, we wrote exclusively for black artists because that's how we felt. And it wasn't until later on that we started to stretch a little bit. And when we moved actually from L.A. to New York, started to write for a broader market.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And if you're just joining us, my guest is the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. And Rhino Records has just brought out a new collection of some of their rock classics. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller are my guests. Now, after you were writing songs for a while, you started producing the records of the people who were doing your songs. This was in the days before record producers were considered to be the auteurs of, you know, of the music industry. What was your approach when you walked in the studio? What did you take control of when you were producing a session?
Everything. From the song, the artist, interpretation, the arrangement, the sound, everything.
Selection of the musicians. Mike essentially picked all the musicians, handpicked the musicians, and did the bones of all the arrangements and played piano on all the record dates, or at least all the great ones. And I was essentially responsible for the performance of the singers.
Right.
And I directed the singers. We worked that way for 40 years, I guess. We're still working that way.
Why did you get into the production? Why did you want that control?
Well, self-defense, really.
We needed to protect the intention of our work because we had had a few experiences early on where we would deliver a song on a piece of paper and it didn't come out the way we had intended it at all. It was another aesthetic entirely.
Give me an example.
And in order to make it sound the way we planned to make it, we had to do it ourselves.
For instance, we'd come in with what we thought was like a sort of a Texas shuffle, you know, a blues,
mm-hmm.
and it would be on paper, and we didn't have a demo, and they would turn it over. Because we were somewhat hot, they'd take it that way, and they would turn it over to an A&R man, say at Capitol or at CBS, whatever. And these were good producers, but they had their own sense of what was correct and what was happening, and they weren't down into rhythm and blues. They were still rooted in swing and jazz at that time. And they would, you know, we would have something that should sound like either a Texas pickup band or Memphis Slim. And they would make a record that would sound like Tommy Dorsey or Benny Goodman's swing band. And it would just be wrong. And so after a couple of these disappointments, we decided to, in self-defense, to learn how to produce records ourselves so we could make our songs come off the way they were intended.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll or to rhythm and
blues. That was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin, and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years, and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this
But it was, right? Jerry heard it, and he said, that sounds like strings. And I said, why not? And so why not? We had five violins and one cello, and they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Was it hard to find string players who could play with the right spirit on a session with the Drifters?
No, they didn't have to play with the right spirit. They just had to play a Caucasian melody. And so we hired a lot of Caucasian string players.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna, with Silvana Mangano, and they had a small Brazilian group, and the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody, and I just loved the rhythm on it, and we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful, and we had the opportunity to use it on this record date. And there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio. And we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp. So he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. And it was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
My guests are the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Are you still writing songs together?
And apart. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
How often do you see each other?
Too often. We see each other about twice a week.
So
sometimes three times a week. We talk every day.
So you still have a close working relationship?
Absolutely.
You were saying that you really thought of yourselves as being black when you were writing for black R&B groups early on. When did that change? When did you start thinking, well, I guess I'm really not black. I'm really white. And when was there a point in your careers when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black when, in fact, you were white?
I don't really remember when it happened. I don't really remember when the transition, I don't think it was abrupt. I think it was gradual.
Uh-huh.
And because you see, when I was a kid growing up, it was where I came from, it was hip to be black, you know? I mean, to be white was kind of square, you know? and the clothes. You know, you had to dress a certain way, and if you looked a certain way and you spoke a certain way, then you were okay. And if you didn't, then you were lame. And all, you know, teenagers especially are very, very conscious about what is hip and what is lame and what is square and what is out and what is in, you know? And, I mean, I grew up right there in the middle of a black culture, and I knew dead on what it was, you know? I mean, firsthand.
And I belonged to a social club in Harlem from the time I was 13 years old, and I used to go up there every weekend. And from there, of course, I used to hang out on 52nd Street and listen to all the jazz musicians in the little clubs. So that was a part of my life.
When I met Stoller, he was sporting a goatee and he was wearing a beret, and he would stand hunched over like he had a humpback, and he'd smoking, and he would say, you say anything to him, you say, you want to go to the movies? He'd say, Or you say, you hungry, man? Let's go eat. He'd go, Because he was like that, right? It wasn't until he was about 21 that he started talking.
So let me ask you again, if there was a point when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black.
I think when Baraka turned to me one day, because Leroy Jones had been my buddy for years, and Leroy in New York told me that I was the greatest living black songwriter. This was when he was Leroy Jones. And about 2 or 3 years later, when the revolution started to happen, right, he informed me that I was white.
How did you respond?
I sort of felt like I'd been betrayed.
I think he was astonished to find out.
I started sitting in the front of the bus.
I haven't asked you, what is your style of working together? Let me go back to when you were writing hits nearly every day. What was your style of working together? Would you be in the same room?
We'd be in the same bathrobes. We were matching bathrobes. Yeah, we'd be in the same room. Actually, Stoller would normally sit at the piano, and I would sort of stalk around the room and smoke. Now, neither of us smoke anymore, so it's taken half the fun out of work. But he would sit at the piano and fiddle, and finally, I don't mean fiddle. I mean fiddle with a piano, you fool.
And Lieber would stalk around the room screaming.
Right.
And if something stuck to the wall, something he screamed, we'd work on it.
We'd take a biopsy and work. But now that was the early days. The way we work these days when we work, I usually have a fix on a lyric, and I'll bring in 8 or 10 or 12 lines, and I'll give it to Mike, and he'll go home and work on it, because this way we can have some time alone.
Which is a delight. And or I will write a melody or half a melody and lay it on Jerry and say, listen, what can you do with this? And then we'll get back together and tear it apart and start over.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Righto. Yeah, it was fun.
A collection of some of the classic songs of Lieber and Stoller has just been released by Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In England, 1977 was the year of the Sex Pistols' first Defiant Records. But there was another music scene happening then, the emergence of dance clubs where they played American funk and soul. It wasn't a political scene, but Isaac Julian says if you were black and gay like he was, it was the place you'd have the most fun and be the most comfortable. Coming up, we talk about his new movie, Young Soul Rebels, which is set in the dance clubs of 1977. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some suggestions for that music fan on your Christmas shopping list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Russian President Boris Yeltsin today took control of the Soviet Foreign Ministry and the Interior Ministry, as well as the Kremlin, the center of Soviet state power. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin has left the Soviet government, clearly now living through its last days, with control of only the Defense Ministry and the Ministry of Atomic Energy, and it won't be more than a few days before Yeltsin takes control of those as well. Yeltsin's decree asserts his immediate control over the Soviet Foreign Ministry, including its financial assets and embassies and other property in foreign countries. No mention was made of the fate of Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze. Yeltsin has also taken control of the Soviet Interior Ministry and the agency of the former KGB charged with domestic intelligence. He plans to create a single ministry dealing with internal security. In taking over the Kremlin, Yeltsin is also asserting control of President Gorbachev's office, including its financial assets and its staff. Yeltsin's actions appear to be part of an agreement worked out with Gorbachev 2 days ago. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Secretary of State James Baker says that he was given assurances on his trip to the Soviet Union that nuclear weapons will be put under a single command and carefully safeguarded. Baker said that the Russian Republic will stay a nuclear power, but three other Soviet republics now with nuclear weapons plan to sign a treaty to ban the spread of nuclear arms and to eventually give them up. Baker gave his findings to the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels, and he also told of the danger of a social explosion and a lack of food in the Soviet Union. In the United States, the scandal-plagued Bank of Credit and Commerce International has agreed to forfeit hundreds of millions of dollars as part of a plea bargain with U.S. investigators. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Federal and New York prosecutors announced today that BCCI's liquidators have agreed to plead guilty to charges including fraud, money laundering, and other forms of racketeering. As part of the deal, the European-based BCCI has acknowledged that it secretly controlled three U.S. banks and will forfeit at least $550 million in assets, half of which will be used to help keep those banks from failing. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says BCCI will also cooperate with ongoing investigations.
This could take years off the time it would otherwise take to investigate and prosecute individual wrongdoers,
such as the bank's owners. Barr says half the bank's American assets will be used to pay back BCCI's innocent depositors around the world. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
In New York City at the UN, diplomats say that the U.S., Britain, and France are considering trade sanctions against Libya because they believe that it had a part in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and a French airliner. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 6 points to close at 2,914. This is NPR News. NATO has agreed to send aid to the Soviet Union and provide air transportation for both food and medicine. Secretary of State Baker, just back from a trip to Moscow, said that the nation's economic condition has grown worse, and just about everyone he met warned of impending chaos. The NATO foreign ministers agreed that recognition for the various Soviet republics will come soon, but urged Moscow to keep nuclear weapons under central command. The German cabinet has agreed to extend diplomatic relations in January to both Slovenia and Croatia. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
At a late evening session, the German cabinet approved recognition of the two breakaway Yugoslavian republics under three conditions: the protection of human rights, the security of minorities, and the acceptance of existing borders. These conditions were laid down by the European Community earlier this week in a resolution allowing member states to recognize Slovenian-Croatian independence. Despite intense diplomatic lobbying by the German government, Bonn has until now remained the only EEC country to announce its impending recognition. The German government decision has unleashed widespread protests in Serbia, where politicians fear growing German influence in Central Europe. The German government today also approved a mixture of economic, legal, and cultural measures to aid Croatia's transition to democracy. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Iceland has now extended diplomatic recognition to Croatia and Slovenia. The breakaway republics had earlier been recognized as nations by the three newly independent Baltic states in Ukraine. In Yugoslavia, outside observers say that they see very little hope for the fighting to end soon. As fighting in Croatia intensified, European Community official Lord Carrington called the situation grim. Both sides have accused the other side of murdering civilians. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In England's official culture, 1977 was the year of the Queen's Silver Jubilee. In youth culture, it was the year of punk rock and the Sex Pistols' first defiant record. But there was another music scene that year in London, dance clubs that specialized in American funk. My guest, Isaac Julian, was 17 years old that year. He was black and gay, and the place he felt most at home was in those clubs. His new movie, Young Soul Rebels, pays tribute to that scene. Julian was a founding member of a collective of British black filmmakers. His other films include This Is Not an AIDS Advertisement and Looking for Langston. Young Soul Rebels is about two young black men who spin American funk records at a British dance club and on a pirate radio station.
And finally, from the Players Association, I Like It. Out now on the Vanguard label. This is Chris.
And this is Kaz coming to you live on
Soul Patrol.
East London's most exclusive P-Funk station. Reminding you to boogie down Club 7 tomorrow.
8 till late. See you there.
Bye.
And may the funk be with you.
1977 is the year of God Save the Queen, the Sex Pistols' now famous song. And punk music seemed to be the music that was the more political music. And I think a lot of people thought of disco as being a fairly mindless scene. What really appealed to you about the culture of the clubs and about that music?
Pleasure. And desire. I mean, I think kind of on the club floor, on the dance floor, you were able to express different desires and expressions which might have been curtailed by kind of your more kind of political movements at the time. I think I shouldn't make too many historical claims for it, but it felt if there was this genuine coming together on the dance floor across kind of race and sexual and kind of gender divides. And this genuine coming together on the dance floor produced a kind of politics of style, which was a form of resistance in trying to be a movement in opposition of the kind of more kind of right-wing fascist tendencies.
So you think that in the clubs it was very multicultural, even though it didn't have an ideology of multiculturalism?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I mean, I think in the clubs, you know, it was very multicultural and multisexual without having the ideology of, you know, a kind of political platform, if you like.
You've said that one of the subjects you try to bring out in your movies is a different type of black masculinity. Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Well, I think in Young Soul Rebels, what I try to do is to kind of explore even ambivalent kind of representations of black masculinity. I suppose what I mean by that is to say that in Young Soul Rebels, I'm interested in a plurality of representations of black masculinities. And these are best represented through the characters and through the protagonists, Chris and Kaz. Chris is straight, he's mixed race. Kaz is black and is gay, and I think in terms of these various questions of black masculinities, that's quite unusual because I think black popular culture and rap has, in a way, very much constructed a very monolithic image of black masculinity. So I think it's very important to try to show, in the same way that maybe black literature might show, a range of black masculinities. And I think that's definitely a very important project of my own in exploring questions of black masculinity in terms of gender construct and in terms of bringing certain questions of sexuality into the arena of a discussion around black masculinity.
When you were growing up, when you were coming of age, did you feel that you couldn't quite fit into the black masculine images that surrounded you in popular culture?
Well, first of all, there weren't many images of black men in popular culture when I was growing up at all. And obviously one of the things that we can take for granted now is that there is. I think growing up, though, that the kind of black men that I knew were not really being at all kind of represented on the screen, and in fact are still not. There still isn't a kind of really full range of different types of black masculinity up on offer. And of course, when it comes to images of kind of black women, I mean, it's really extremely limited.
It's funny. Do you think that a lot of the black funk music that you've listened to over the years reinforces the image of black masculinity that you felt you didn't fit into?
No, maybe exactly the opposite. In fact, kind of, well, definitely in the kind of songs, at least, black music and some music was the first articulations of black desire. And I think in the 70s that maybe there was a more fluidity in those representations in music.
Well, you had somebody like Sylvester, and then there was Parliament Funkadelic talking about being freaky and everything. So, you know, opening up the door to a lot of possibilities.
Absolutely. And I think kind of like, you know, in a way, it's because of those interventions in popular culture that you have a kind of slightly more liberated look even in relationship to black masculinities. I think now all that's slightly closing down. There seems to be really only a homeboy image of black masculinity, which is very straight and very
homophobic too, don't you?
Homophobic, absolutely.
You have a book about the making of Young Soul Rebels, and in the book, you said that you had second thoughts about casting straight actors in the gay roles. What were the kinds of dilemmas that you faced or problems that you had?
Well, I think the main problem is really kind of one of having to cope with actors' anxieties in relationship to playing gay roles, not because of their own inhibitions, but because of what people will say and what it would do in terms of their kind of, you know, job prospects. But I think, all in all, kind of like there usually are at least several tensions between directors and actors. And I think what happened on Young Rebels wasn't really that unusual. I think in terms of black actors obviously playing gay characters, obviously that's a risk. And I think it's a risk which paid off for an actor like Moses Essey, because he's now kind of playing a lead in a film which is being shot in Hong Kong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Isaac Julian, and he's a British film director whose new movie is called Young Soul Rebels. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Isaac Julian, director of the new film Young Soul Rebels, which is set in England in 1977. I want to ask you a few things about yourself. Your parents were from the West Indies. They moved to England, I believe, in the 1950s.
That's right.
What brought them to England?
Because the streets were paved with gold. I mean, like, you know, what brings any kind of immigrants to other countries usually is to improve their kind of living conditions. And in England, the mother country was supposed to look after its kind of citizens of the Commonwealth. And of course they didn't. And of course my parents have learnt better. And of course I've learnt from them.
Did you grow up in a West Indian neighbourhood?
Well, in England, we don't really have the same kind of segregationist practices as people have to endure here in America. Even in a so-called black area like Brixton, there'd be at least kind of 50% white people living in that area. So the area I grew up actually was very much like the area that Kaz and Chris grew up in, which is best represented in Young Soul Rebels on their estate, where there were kind of black people, but also quite a lot of white people.
In Young Soul Rebels, some of the young white people are skinheads and are pretty racist. Did you grow up with that too?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a very kind of normal kind of representation, I think, in relationship to kind of black young people growing up in Britain during the 60s and the 70s.
Were you ever, you know, beaten up? Did you have to learn to fight and everything growing up in the neighbourhood?
Of course. Yes, I mean, the neighbourhood that I suppose you could say that quite a lot of rednecks lived on my estate. That would be the best way of describing the situation. And one did have to learn to stick up for oneself. But, I mean, one did generally, because where I grew up in East London, which was a traditionally kind of working class area and a traditionally an immigrant area, it was quite a tough area too. So one had to defend oneself and learn to do that very quickly at an early age.
Do you want to get in your movies the kind of style that really excited you back in 1977? You know, when style was really important to you when you were a teenager, is now style really important to you as a filmmaker?
Absolutely. I mean, I think style is almost everything, actually, when it comes to making films. If they don't look stylish, people don't want to see them. And so kind of like that's very important. And it was very important to me in 1977 in terms of like how I would dress and how I would want to look and present myself. And it is in my films. And I think that's because probably of my kind of fine art painting background, you know, that I do think a lot about colour, I do think a lot about decor, I do think a lot about where you place people in relationship to the frame, and all those things are just as important as, like, what kind of jacket you'd wear.
Filmmaker Isaac Julian, he directed and co-wrote the new movie Young Soul Rebels. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear news from Moscow today about Boris Yeltsin, the Russian president, taking control of the Kremlin and of nearly all the ministries of the soon-to-disband Soviet Union. We'll also be hearing another report on sexual harassment by Noah Adams, this one about how one co-ed vocational school deals with incidents of sexual harassment, and a talk with a psychologist who has a theory that you can predict recessions by the pessimism of popular song lyrics 1 to 2 years before the economy takes a downturn.
That sounds interesting. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pick up a pen and paper or open that file on your computer marked Gift Ideas. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some recommendations.
The This month, are you stalking through record stores looking for something to buy a jazz fan for Christmas? Or do you hate the holidays and just want some good new stuff for yourself? If you ask a store clerk for advice and they tell you to buy the new one by Wynton Marsalis or Harry Connick Jr., get out of there fast. The four records Wynton put out this year are pretty sleepy, and as a jazz musician, Connick is a joke. But if you're looking for some solid mainstream jazz like the Marsalis brothers play, get the album The Cat by tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin. At age 63, he's got twice as much to say as any four players half his age, and this time out he wrote himself some very nice tunes. You heard a little of his composition The Cat a minute ago. Here's some more. If you're shopping for a fan whose tastes are slightly more modern, but you don't want to listen to anything too frenetic when you visit them, try the duet album Falling Man by saxophonist and flutist Marty Ehrlich and bassist Anthony Cox. They're forward-looking musicians who aren't afraid to play pretty, and this CD is a sleeper that slid by too many folks. Another musician more people should know about is pianist Myra Melford. Melford was trained in classical music and Chicago blues. She has a lyrical sensibility, but her solos carry a real rhythmic jolt. Her trio's debut album is called Jump. Saw a major revival of interest in the great singer and pianist Nat King Cole. There are lots of new records and a new book about Cole out, but I can't recommend much of it. Leslie Gorse's biography, Unforgettable, was kind of sloppily written and edited. Natalie Cole's hit album, Unforgettable, struck me as pretty mushy, without the jazz feel that made her father's pop records great. The mail order label Mosaic has just put out a huge box set of Nat Cole trio recordings, including a ton of previously unreleased stuff. But as it costs $270, it's a bit much for the casual fan, let alone your Christmas budget. A lot of Cole's classic vocal albums have been reissued, of which my favorite is the jazz session After Midnight. But you might consider the new CD by Nat's brother, the endearing Freddie Cole. You gotta love a guy who has a piano, guitar, and bass trio just like Nat's, sings and plays remarkably like his brother, does a Nat Cole medley and his own tribute to Nat King Cole on the album, and then wraps it up by insisting, "I'm not my brother, I'm me." That's also the CD's title.
Now his name was Nat, and my name is Fred. Now we look alike, so it's been said. But I'll stress a point to make you see that I am not my brother, I'm me. Now I'm here to entertain you in my own special way. And if I sound like Nat, well, what can I say? Now I
apology, because I am not my brother, I'm me.
If you and yours prefer your jazz electrified, one of this year's best bets is David Sanborn's album, Another Hand, on which the commercial saxophonist mixes it up with creative players like guitarist Bill Frisell, bassist Charlie Hayden, and pianist Terry Adams of the rock band NRBQ. Another good one is the album Ask the Ages by the rock-influenced jazz guitarist Sonny Chirac. He plays in a quartet with Pharoah Sanders on tenor sax and Elvin Jones on drums. As far as reissues go, this season there are three new collections of Billie Holiday recordings on the Columbia, Decca, and Verve labels, which among them survey that unbeatable singer's career from beginning to end. Folks in love with the romance of suffering prefer her later sides, but the buoyant singing of the young Holiday is best, so get the Columbia 3-CD box set called The Legacy. Most of it comes from the 1930s and early 40s. This is a nice gift for someone who doesn't love jazz yet, because it'll help them hear why they should. Okay, those are my Christmas picks, but remember, don't fret too much about getting exactly the right thing for the jazz fans on your list. They'll be heading down to the mall to exchange other stuff anyway.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. The albums he recommended are by Johnny Griffin, Marty Ehrlich, and Anthony Cox, Myra Melford, Freddie Cole, David Sanborn, Sonny Chirac, and Billie Holiday. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, cross-dressing, why some people dress in drag and why it makes other people so uncomfortable. We talk with Harvard professor Marjorie Garber about how cross-dressing challenges our preconceptions about gender. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.